It's Saturday, May 9th, 2009, 10:06 a.m. on the Central Coast of California. Today on GeekSpeak, geek news and discussion about color management.
Racist.
The bandwidth for GeekSpeak.org is provided by GNI, GNIHosting.com.
Welcome to GeekSpeak, bridging the gap between geeks and the rest of humanity. I'm your host, Lyle Troxell. Please keep in mind the views expressed during GeekSpeak are not necessarily those of KOSP. Today, we're talking about color management on the computer. Ever notice how your camera takes a picture, you load it into your computer, and then when you print it out, if you look at every one of those, all the color is different. It's very frustrating. Well, today we learned a bit about how and why this happens and what you can do about it. During the second half of the show, I'll welcome you to join our conversation. The numbers are 476-2800, toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. Of course, you can go to geekspeak.org right now, send us a note, participate on our forum, send us an email, and I'll give out that contact information again when I invite your participation in about a half an hour. You can also join us live on the public chat. We're doing a little geek chat. Just go to today's show, and on the left-hand side, you see geek chat, and join us there. It'd be great. This is GeekSpeak. My name's Lyle Troxell. In the air with me are geeks. Ben Jaffe is a freelance media guy. Morning, Ben.
Good morning.
And we have Miles Elam, slacker and political junkie. Morning, Miles.
Good morning.
I didn't mean to call you a racist.
The color management thing, that was pretty funny. Thank you very much. And Al Lucca, new media architect.
There's a power surge in the graviton warp compensators.
Oh, you should restart the central deflector power modification chips.
There are fluctuations in the ion instantiator.
You should tune the impulse distortion field with anion polarity units.
Looks like you guys saw Star Trek.
Of course.
Oh, yeah.
I'm very jealous. I smelled a little Trekkie when I came
like
in the room.
Smells like nerd.
Miles, we on that tonight?
Yes.
I want a confirmation. Okay, you're all witnesses. You're taking me to the movie tonight, right?
No, you're taking me.
Oh, dang.
Okay. You're paying.
All right.
No spoilers on GeekSpeak. I just want to say, go see the movie.
Yeah. Okay, good.
That's it.
We don't want to talk about it, right?
Mm-mm.
Except that you guys got to see it, like, opening, so there's the big excitement lines. Did you see it in costume?
It was kind of sad.
The normal geek costumes that people wear.
I saw it in Oakland at 7 o'clock on the 7th, and it was really funny because, you know, one person, like some guy in a Trek uniform with a phaser would, you know, sneak into the theater, you know, and then, like, you know, freeze and fire someone at someone and whatever. And then you'd see, you know, his wife walk around the corner just, like, with their hand in their head, like, or their head in their hand.
Let's get on with some geek news so we sound like we know what we're talking about. Also in the air is bioengineering BS from Berkeley and our guest today, Sun Do. Welcome here today.
Good morning.
If we make mistakes in the news or you want to add to it, please feel free to do so. And we'll talk about your company and color management in about 15 minutes or 20 minutes. Okay, so first person's news story would be Ben Jaffe. Mr. Jaffe, hi.
Hello. I want to talk about the electronic nose. Have you heard about this?
Can it smell Trekkies?
It might be able to.
I've heard stories about, you know, sensing. There's some great robotic artwork where they send out little robots that can smell different chemicals in fields, and they congregate around things that are bad.
Yeah, the other show we were talking about, tricorders, and how cell phones were, you know, kind of like tricorders and everything. I mean, this kind of device, if it was in a cell phone, would make it much more like a tricorder.
What can the electronic nose do?
Well, we've been working on this technology for like 25 years or something. We've been developing it all this time. So way back in the 90s, in 1995 for the Mir space station, the European Space Agency developed this electronic nose, and its purpose was to monitor the air inside of the Mir space station. And it turns out that was actually a really good investment, because in 1997 there was a minor fire on the Mir space station, and it detected the early signs and warned everyone about it.
Wait, so is it a smoke detector, or is it?
No, it's not just a smoke detector though. There are differences in the way it works. It actually somewhat emulates the way our noses work.
Okay.
Whereas a smoke detector is something that's very specific,
looks
specifically
for particles.
looking for certain kinds of particles.
This and the smoke detector is designed to annoy you when you're making toast. That's what
exactly.
Right.
Yeah, and make
and
the really annoying.
And this gives you information.
Yeah, so we've actually found that this technology, so there's one now that's going up to the International Space Station, and some researchers have been playing with this, and turns out that they can actually detect odor differences between normal cells and cancerous brain cells.
Really?
With this electronic nose device.
Does that help much, considering, you know, the cells are inside your brain, or does the nose have to like crack a hole? This astronaut has problems.
But the whole idea, though, is that I mean that's a really good way to tell whether a cell is cancerous or not. You can actually, I mean, apparently they've known for a while that dogs can do this, because dogs have a very keen sense of smell. But I mean, just the ways in which this technology is being used is really, really interesting. It's being used in the Stockholm Underground to detect fires in the system there. And so also back in 95 when we put this up, or when the European Space Agency put it up, one of the great advantages of this was that they built it for use in space, which means it has to survive a number of things. It has to survive the cold temperatures and the boiling hot temperatures. It also has to be able to survive the vibration when you shoot it in outer
sure.
space. And also, it's not as susceptible to humidity. It's not as susceptible to being jammed with fine dust. And humidity and fine dust are two things that are definitely worrisome when you're using a smoke detector in the underground, you know, rail system.
Right.
Is that so? This technology is a lot better than traditional smoke detectors, and
very cool.
And you know, same with like carbon monoxide and things like that. So anyway, very, very cool technology.
You know, I have this image in my head of the movie 2001, only changed from, you know, the HAL 9000 talking about their operational ones to Dave, I think you need to take a shower.
Dave, I can smell you. I can smell you're going to shut me down.
Yeah, speaking of HAL, don't you have a news story with HAL in it?
Yeah, that's funny you said that. It's almost as if we planned the show out or something.
we didn't plan that out.
Yeah, we actually... Anyhow, there's this thing that I ran across by a company named Cyberdyne, Well, you know... I thought, this has got to be a joke, but I went through, and this is a real company. They're in Japan, and Cyberdyne, for those of you who don't remember, is the fictional company that was from the movie Terminator that built, you know, the Terminator. So there's an actual company named Cyberdyne, and they actually make a thing that kind of looks like Terminator. And it's real, and it's what they call an exoskeleton. They've named it, it's actually named HAL, the Hybrid Assisted Limb. Which it looks pretty cool. It can actually multiply your strength by a factor of 10 for up to 5 hours. So it's, and it kind of goes along your legs. It's like an exoskeleton. It kind of goes around, it connects to your feet and everything. And it senses this motor neuron response along your skin. You know, when you move, your brain sends a motor neuron signal mm-hmm. to your muscles, and it senses this thing, and then it interprets it, and then it's able to, you know, move it to its.
And you basically, it's kind of like you're wearing these muscles. It's an exoskeleton.
It's a suit. It's kind of bulky.
The thing I always fear, it scares me about those things. If it reads it wrong and it bends your arm in a way that your arm can't do it, or it overrides your muscles.
They have a thing in there that actually. There is a mode where it will actually do the work for you. So mm-hmm. it will actually not wait for your muscles not wait for the signal. It'll actually help you, you know, for therapy and things like that. You know, maybe you're walking around, you got to walk up something really tall and you don't feel like walking. So you just turn it on. It just walks for you.
Right.
You just like walk in, but like.
See, that's horrific. And then someone else controls it, you know, with a joystick, and they're making
it. Or you hack it, or you make somebody. I think, you know, there's a Wallace and Gromit about this exact thing called The Wrong Trousers.
Someone has children.
So it's a HAL 5. We just need to keep track of those numbering systems and watch when they get close to the 101. So they're.
Right.
You know, yeah.
Cyberdyne Systems Model 101, that's not okay, but the 5, we're okay with. We can, you know, watch as things are progressing.
Well,
stay in the double digits.
Keep an eye on it.
At least they're not flying, because the thing about the Cyberdyne from the Terminator movie is one of the first things they make are these flying ships that kill people.
Uh-huh.
So at least they're not, robots aren't flying.
Yet. Well, you know, you mentioned flying, and of course, that moves me to my next subject.
Does it sound like we're doing this intentionally?
You know,
because that
weird.
One we did intentionally.
It's one
I completely
of those
did that intentionally.
Mercury lining up with something other today.
Go on.
there's the Martin jetpack. Maybe people have heard of this before. Martin's, you know, a company that's been working on the jetpack, which, of course, when I run across new things about jetpacks, there are always going to be something I bring up.
Because right, when we all have them, it will be the future.
It's really time, people, that we get moving on this jetpack idea. I watched the Jetsons when I was a kid, and I thought for sure by the time I was 20, we'd have jetpacks.
No offense, Al, but I've seen the drivers in Santa Cruz. I don't want them.
Yeah, I was going to say.
As well.
You know, I don't know.
They can't handle a 2D space. How are they going to handle a 3D space?
How about one just for me then? well, they Martin has another. They've got a video out. It's, you know, we've got the URL on our website. It's a gas turbine powered thing. It's called a jetpack. It's not really a jet though, because it's, you know, the way these things work. It's just a common name to call it, because everybody calls it. It's really like a fan jet. It's got two big fans on it, and they have a video of it. There's multiple videos on their website, and the guy is like on it, and he's driving around in the air inside a warehouse untethered. Like, whenever you see these things, somebody's always like,
and for a period of time too. It's not like one of those 15 seconds.
He's like, he's driving all over the place. And then, you know, the things you think about are, well, what happens if it just stops or something, you know? And they're saying it's safer than a helicopter because it actually has a parachute in it. It as one of their safety features.
Helicopters, you can auto-rotate down, though.
They've got a big thing about how this is safer than a helicopter. It doesn't have rotors, you know, but you don't have the tail thing. And it's got a ballistic parachute that is like this super fast, like, poof, you know, like,
right.
You immediately.
Well, assuming you're not.
Is that the emergency brake?
Yeah.
It's probably one of the emergency brakes from a race.
How high would you be with one of these things, though? I mean, I would imagine
I'd
want
to be pretty high if I had a parachute.
You don't want to
be three stories up with a parachute. It doesn't help you much.
Yeah, they have a roll cage too. I mean, it has like a roll cage around it. These are the safety features.
All right, jetpacks, awesome.
Wait, yeah. So both of your news stories are things that could very easily kill you if they malfunction.
Right.
Like, I would not want to be surrounded by a suit that, if it decided it didn't like me, it could just kill me, just like that. That'd be bad.
Well, look what happened on the wrong trousers.
You know, the thing is, your car could do that too, right? I mean, the system's in the car. Well, there is a CPU in there. It does manage things.
But
the
electronic
braking assist system. Well, it's redundant and it's clean and all that. But theoretically, if someone programmed it correctly, they could make the brakes not work. There's still smarts in there.
Well, you would still be able to turn off the car and get one good, you know, pump on the brake fluid and everything. I mean, manual mechanisms that are in place. I mean, I guess you could say the same. Never mind. I don't even know what I'm saying.
Anyway,
it's just like in just a moment, though. It could just.
But
if you could get
the Cyberdyne thing, so you have the superhuman strength and you could fly in this jetpack,
you could take over the world.
And if you made it the size of an iPhone,
that's next.
That would pretty much.
Miles,
do it.
Your next news story.
Right then. Switching gears.
Miles is like, you're all crazy.
I guess I would say it to your face, but MPAA, Motion Picture Association of America.
The group we love to hate.
Well, it's a consortium of companies that are responsible for making a lot or producing and distributing a lot of the movies that we see.
Don't they create the rating system too?
They control it, yes. Yeah. One of the areas where copyright and film has always had an uneasy truce has been education. Education has always been considered part of the fair use harbor for teachers to be able to say, okay, I want to have this clip, I'm going to play it, even though it's under other circumstances it would be a public performance.
Right.
Or that they would have to pay an extra licensing fee for
especially in public schools, right? The idea that a teacher can say they're talking about something and they want to talk about ships, like history about Titanic. So they show a clip from the Titanic movie and they go, okay, that didn't happen. And they start talking about it. It's a great way to get students involved, but it requires them to have that in the room with them.
Right. And we've all had, like when we were younger, having projectors in a classroom or VHS, VCRs. Now we're in the DVD age and even moving on to the Blu-ray age. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of material is only available on DVD.
Right.
Or newer media. And so teachers will want to play some clips, except that the MPAA is saying, wait, no, we don't want you to do that.
DVDs?
They don't want the teachers to be making copies. Many times teachers will make remixes. They'll or what now is being called remixes. They'll take a little clip from one VHS tape, you know,
right,
so that they can have all of their lesson plans together.
Titanic analogy, they might have stills about the actual ship, stills from the construction of it, and a few other stills, right? And then they also might have some video from a movie. So they kind of want to put that in one media solution so that they can just pop it in and start playing.
Or just put some video onto their laptop to be able to skip through very quickly.
Oh, and yeah, putting on a laptop's a really good point. It's because a lot of the way that they're showing things in the classrooms now are using projectors. So the teacher has a projector and they have a laptop, and actually getting a VHS or DVD player in there just is an extra step on their time.
Right. Now, the reason I'm bringing all this up is because the MPAA is vehemently against ripping DVDs. In other words, copying a movie from a DVD onto a hard drive. And so there's now this battle of, wait, but this has always been fair use. Well, the MPAA has tried to be magnanimous about it and said, oh, well, we have a solution. Take that DVD, put it onto a TV and play it, and then take a video camera and record it onto a video recorded by a video camera.
Oh, man.
As opposed to just using software that's been available for the better part of a decade.
So they are asking people to use the analog hole.
Right.
Which is absurd, because all this time they've been trying to get rid of the analog hole with audio.
Right.
By using DRM and not using just plain MP3s.
And, of course, using a video camera to record a TV screen playing some media is going to have a horrible degradation of quality.
Oh, yeah, you're going to have frame rates that are not
insane. So if
you're
right now,
if you're covering, like, let's say you're in a film class or even many things that require an attention to detail, that if you can't get that detail, it totally destroys the purpose for having the education.
So teachers are saying, look, how are we supposed to deal with this DVD thing? And the answer from this
the
consortium, MPAA, says you've got to play it on a normal, on a screen and videotape it. No, don't use the ripping software because we don't like that idea.
Right.
Okay.
You know what?
So if you're a teacher and you're listening to Geek Speak, you know a teacher, please go ahead and use the ripping software because it's a lot better for your students.
You know,
of course, that's a legal.
We level. Are not lawyers. This is should not be construed as legal advice.
There's something even more disturbing.
This is only entertainment.
There's something even more disturbing about this whole thing, about the DVD players, the simple playing of them. It's threatening an age-old position for us geeks in grade school.
What's that? Oh, right.
I mean, if a teacher can just walk up and play the DVD player themselves.
What are we supposed to do? How are we supposed to make brownie points?
I mean, there's a few of us out there who might have had a position in grade school that might have been somebody who operated some of these things. You know who you are. We all know this position well.
You're the classroom. Yeah.
If you're not sure if you're the person, if you think about four or five corrections that you want to tell us every show, you're one of those people.
Yeah. No, I was actually thinking, if you're not sure if you're one of those people, you're not one of those people.
Okay, so that's ridiculous. But the truth is, though, that the protections on the DVD fall under the Millennium Copyright Act protections. And if you do rip the DVD, you're theoretically breaking that law.
Right. The idea that the Digital Millennium Copyright Act added in provisions that if they had applied to previous media, people would have been up in arms saying this is totally unacceptable.
Right.
But because it was in the digital space, most people didn't notice it until you know, 8 years
and
later.
Here's an example of the Millennium Copyright and how ridiculous it is. If I go ahead and make a home DVD and I put encrypt, you know, I protect it for some reason because I feel like doing that, and then I later take that DVD and insert it and rip it, I'm breaking the law because I'm overseeing someone.
You're circumventing
encryption protection. Right?
Yeah,
it doesn't matter if I own the whole process. But.
And it doesn't matter how badly done the encryption is. The act of trying to break an encryption is
so you can legally protect like an email to someone by just taking the sentences and rotating them slightly and then telling someone over the phone, take the third sentence and put it at the first. If anybody else reads that and actually deciphers it, they're theoretically breaking the Millennium Copyright Act. That's how ridiculous it is. But anyway, let's go on to something else. Ben, let's talk about alcohol.
Let's talk about alcohol.
Okay.
Are you old enough to drink yet, Ben?
No, I'm only 16.
Okay, go on.
But so it seems that my theme for stories this week is technology and processes that are being repurposed. So I want to talk about radiocarbon dating and how it relates to whiskey. So bottles of vintage whiskey can sell for thousands and thousands of dollars each, right? Mm-hmm. what's to keep people from saying, oh, this bottle that I actually made 2 years ago, hush, hush, is actually hundreds of years old, you know, and, right. and get tons of money. And a lot of people have been doing that with, you know, forging the or claiming that this whiskey that they have is way older than it is.
Sure.
Turns out that they can actually use radiocarbon dating to figure out the actual age of this whiskey, which is really cool. So, like,
I thought radiocarbon dating was really only applicable for certain time frames.
Well, it is because it's like up to 60,000 years back, right? Yeah. So it's these bigger chunks of time, these bigger slices mm-hmm. of time. You can't say, oh, this is 1983 whiskey, right. not 1985 whiskey. However, we have been ever since the 1950s. Artificially elevating the levels of carbon-14, which is what we use for radiocarbon dating, because we've had the nuclear bomb tests. And so we have this barley that's growing out in these fields, and this barley is absorbing more carbon-14 if it was made after 1950. And so if you analyze this whiskey, you can tell if it's at least that old. And if it's older than that, you can get a rough estimate, maybe within right. like 5 or 10 years or maybe 20 years.
Right, but it's a really clean demarcation when we started doing nuclear testing.
Yeah, definitely. And so, you know, if something's older than 60 years old, then it's a little more difficult. It's also probably more valuable. But if something's 20 years old or, you know, 3 months old, and people are trying to pass it off as whiskey that was, you know, hundreds of years old and trying to make money off of that, we can actually tell now. We can actually take a very small sample, send it off to the lab and perform radiocarbon dating on it and figure it out. And it turns out that of the samples that they've tested, there have been more fakes
Of course.
Than there have been examples.
And they've tested a lot of samples,
yeah.
I bet.
That's what... Yeah, they
I volunteer.
Sure, sure.
I'll test.
I'll drink it. I've got a radiocarbon dating lab in my stomach. No.
What are you gonna do with all that whiskey that is left over there?
Yeah. So that's at the Oxford Radiocarbon Accelerator Unit.
Awesome. Okay.
Very cool stuff.
To finish off our news segment before we get into the second half of the show, let's just handle tomorrow. Al.
Oh, it's Mother's Day, and I came across a couple little Mother's Day gifts. I don't know if – just sort of interesting things to mention. If you're an expectant mother, I've seen some T-shirts, loading please wait, and it's got a little progress bar on the T-shirt. A pregnant woman wears that. See, there's also another one that's got like the Intel logo that says geek inside.
For pregnant women.
Which is another pregnant woman.
That's cool.
And I also saw there's some printed circuit board necklaces. We have all these URLs up. And just some little ideas. Anything, anytime you can give it. You know, Mother's Day is every day, actually. So, you know, a little, they make necklaces out of old printed circuit boards. You know, it's recycling. You know, they say 3% of all the electronic waste is circuit boards. So you're kind of, you know, doing something good and making a piece of jewelry. And they're all unique. And then there's the other things, the more expensive things. There's a new notebook out, a netbook out that's by Vivian Tam. It's a designer netbook. Has flowers and looks very
oh, the shell is
feminine
actually pretty.
Looking kind of netbook.
And the netbooks are the ones that are really, really small.
Yes.
So you could actually put it in a large handbag.
Right. And I, you know, I'm just starting to feel like netbooks, you know, they're very cool and everything, but I think they're kind of drifting towards, I mean, not necessarily hardcore geek women, but the general woman fashion accessory. It seems like that kind of device is going to be picked up mostly by that type of person that wants
that are getting their nails done
that
and
wants
have the small dog.
The netbook to match their purse.
That's
and their dog.
Not necessarily our audience, right? Let me tell you. I don't want to say anything about women.
Yes,
and,
I bought one to match my purse. That's
yeah,
right.
Good. And your nails.
And Miles. Yeah,
and so. Your dog. Little
that's
dog.
Just my own opinion about these networks.
Well, your designer
I know a mother that actually really wants a new phone app, an iPhone app called the iPhaser, just with Stun.
Hmm.
So you can deal with the kids.
I could use that one.
No, she wants two settings. She wants Stun and Kill.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay. For other people.
No, there's no parent that doesn't want Stun and Kill. Stun actually hurts, and you threaten with the kill.
I see.
GeekSpeak on QSP is supported by Henry J. Ramirez, DDS in Santa Cruz, specializing in cosmetic and family dentistry, using digital technology for less radiation, and offering one appointment crowns and veneers. For appointments and more information, 423-2447. We're going to take your calls about color management, about our topic as we start that. So if you're welcome to join the conversation in about 10 minutes or so with questions about color management. The phone numbers are 476-2800. Again, 476-2800 or toll free at 1-800-655-5877. Again, that's 1-800-655-5877. You're listening to Central Coast Public Radio, KOSP, Santa Cruz, KBDH San Arturo. This is Lyle Troxell. This is Geek Speak. In the air room, I have Ben Jaffe and Al Luckow and Miles Elam. In a moment, we'll be introducing my guest as well. Geek Speak on KOSP is supported by Great Infusions Coffee Beanery and Espresso Machinery Showroom, offering artisans coffee, coffee makers, and specializing in home espresso machines, parts, and repairs. Located at 317
Potrero
Street on the corner of River Street in Santa Cruz, or online at greatinfusions.com. Sun Doe, co-founder of Rods and Cones, Inc., in 1996. He provides technical expertise and insight on color management and is integrated into digital workflow. He has years of experience with color management and the issues around it. Sun Doe has a Bachelor's of Science in bioengineering from Stanford. Is that right, Sun?
Berkeley.
Berkeley, sorry. Yeah, they're close. Welcome to Geek Speak.
Thank you.
You know, people have killed for less than that.
He doesn't have an eye phaser. Son.
Yeah, but you know, I'm pretty good with programming, and I think you're right.
If
Miles,
I got into a robot,
stun
you'd be able
and
to take
kill.
It
yes, stun and kill.
So, Son, color management. I mean, it's very common for people to take pictures, see them on their screen, then print them out or take them to a print bureau, and they're all different. All the color is different. Why is this happening?
Why is this happening? Well, you know what? Do you like toast in the morning?
I do.
All right, I like toast in the morning. I like my toast a really nice golden shade of brown. I have a toaster, a Black & Decker, you know. And over the years, the number 3 in my toaster gives me a really nice golden brown that I like.
Okay.
I go visit you for a weekend. Don't know why, but let's say I've gone off my rocker.
Let's say I have some interesting toast to show you.
You have an interesting toast, right. And, you know, you're one of those fruity people who watch the cooking channel, and you've got a KitchenAid, and it's got, like, much fancier settings than my little Black & Decker. And I wake up in the morning, put a slice of toast in there, turn to number 3. It's like, God darn it. This 3 setting is, like, you know, really light. It's not a golden brown. You know, and I accept that. You know, my number 3 toaster, my setting 3, is not going to produce the same color as your number 3.
As my fancy one. And my fancy one actually goes up to 11. So.
Yeah, you guys are going to 11. So you're still asleep. And I'm like, well, I can't eat this. This is way too light. So I stick another piece of toast in. I go 4. That's not it. Stick another piece of bread in. 5.
Yeah, this is the printing over and over again.
Yeah, this is the printing over and over again. Yeah, yeah. So you're familiar with it, you know? And after a while, I hit number 10, and I go, wait a minute. Your number 10 is what produces the same color as my number 3. So that's what color management is all about, and that's why we have such differences. Because, you know, you have a monitor. It displays color one way. You have a printer.
Why do they all do this? Why is it that we have monitors out there that don't have exactly the same thing? I mean, it's so
frustrating. Competition. You know, people make you know, if you actually look at monitors, they're made of little tiny pixels, red, green, and blue. Mm-hmm. But the red, and from that red, green, and blue, they mix all the colors that you see on your monitor. But the exact shade of your red pixel is not the exact shade of my red pixel.
And that's just because they're using different technology?
Because they're different glass manufacturers and different suppliers, etc.
Yeah. It actually gets really complicated because what's really happening on the screen sometimes, you actually have a lot more blue than any other of the colors because the eye is not as sensitive to blue. To make a really rich blue, it takes a lot more power. So basically, you sometimes there's different counts of the pixels.
That's true.
So it does get really complicated. So, okay, but I'm assuming that there's a way to do this such that in your computer, you have, I mean, this is what the color profiles are for, right? There's these ideas of profiles.
Yep.
One of the things that's always confused me about a color profile, if I see my screen and I'm calibrating my screen, what am I calibrating my screen to?
Ah, okay. So let's talk a little bit about that toaster analogy again. So I have one toaster, you have a different toaster, and we have two different devices. What if there was an agreed upon standard? What if the U.S. manufacturer of all toasters got together and said, you know what, let us all agree that we will make a master toaster and we will reference all of our toasters back to this one standard. So when you calibrate your monitor, you're basically referencing a particular set of standards that the color industry has gone together and said, if you calibrate your monitor to this particular shade of white, to this particular illumination, then we can use that as a base for all of our color management.
So, the thing is, I've been in my laptop before, and I've done color management without any external thing except for my eyes.
Yes.
Right? And they walk me through a step. Is that really profiling it? No.
No.
You need some external source, right? You need either a sample to match against or some kind of sensor.
you need a sensor. Uh-huh. And there's a lot of sensors out there. They're fairly inexpensive. They range anywhere between like $100 to $250. You know, for the common user, they might be a bit much. But if you really are doing a lot of photography, you're doing a lot of printing, you really want your monitor to look correct, buy one of these sensors, and it does exactly what it's meant to do. It will display, it comes with some software, it'll display a whole bunch of different colors on the monitor, and so, actually measure the color that comes off the monitor.
Okay, so let me give you kind of describe this. What would you do is you'd show the computer would say, show white, and then the sensor would come up here and say, that's not the white we're looking for. And it would then, it would say,
modify the signal.
It would basically say, we want to modify this much. And then that information, how much you modify the signal, then goes back in the computer. So then the next time the computer displays that white, it adds that modification layer onto it and actually displays the right color for your screen.
Correct.
It's like an offset, yeah.
Yeah, and that's what a color profile is. It's merely a whole table listing of transformations that say, this monitor is off by this much in this color range, on this much in this color range.
So does that mean the application itself handles it or the operating system handles it?
It depends. Now, if you're on the Mac, the operating system can handle it. On Windows, a little dicier. Most programs, though, that are serious about color actually reference the profiles that are part of the Mac or the Windows OS itself.
Okay.
But they do the color transformation in their internally inside of their app.
So they ignore the OS. They say, OS, don't do this.
Yes.
Turn off color management.
Yes.
And I'm going to do it for you, but I'm going to use your file.
Yes.
Okay, that's pretty cool. The other thing that always confuses me is when I open a Photoshop document and it says, this has a color profile against it. Why would you have a profile against a file? Wouldn't you want the file to be universal and then the modifications are all about the output sources?
Well, yes, that would be a perfect world, but there are lots of different ways to deal with color. So most of when you open up a file in Photoshop, it's usually made up of either red, green, and blue channels, or it's made up of cyan, yellow, magenta, and black. It's made up of one of those two modes. The problem is that there are different standards out there for what color that red is, what color that blue is, and what color that green is, as well as for what color cyan, yellow, magenta, and black should be. It's sort of like going to the paint store and saying, you know, I want cerulean blue. But if you buy it from, say, Home Depot cerulean blue, or if you buy it from Lowe's, you're going to get slightly different mixes. So red, green, and blue aren't absolute. So when you open up a file, what Photoshop is telling you is saying, this red, green, and blue digital file that you have in here, your flavor of it might be sRGB, which is a standard RGB space developed by HP and Windows.
So what you're
it might be Adobe RGB, which is RGB numbers developed by Adobe.
Okay, you just got confusing because you're basically saying is that even though we have a universal idea of what white or red might be, we actually don't. We have a whole bunch of ways of talking about red and white.
Yes.
Is that what you're saying?
You know what? It's kind of interesting. I say we have standards, but
we have lots of standards.
We have lots of standards. Okay. It's like, you know, you have standards, and there are basically about three standard red, green, and blue spaces that are available to you.
And you just mentioned sRGB.
sRGB.
What are the other ones?
sRGB, Adobe RGB, and another popular one is called Profoto RGB.
I've heard of those too. Okay. Yeah. So when I correct my monitor, which one of those am I using?
That's the theory, is that you're not using any one of those. You're correcting your monitor to an agreed-upon monitor standard.
Okay.
And then what will happen is that when you open up something in sRGB, Photoshop will go, okay, this file, these numerical values are sRGB numbers, and your monitor's calibrated, so I will now display these sRGB numbers correctly on your calibrated monitor. If it happens to be Adobe RGB, it will know how to now do the transformation
to Adobe
RGB.
So shouldn't every photo editing or any image editing thing know about those profiles and always use them?
Yes.
So why is it?
There's a whole other layer to that, actually, that in that when you, especially since you mentioned Photoshop, it's going to take into consideration your output format. So, you know, you might have swap coded paper or coded stock or matte stock or something. And then there's that other level where Photoshop's going to try to adjust the color based on, it's going to try to figure out what this is really going to look like when it's printed on this kind of glossy stock. It changes. So in addition to your monitor just being an average good color, you also have that other dimension of profiles where, oh, you know, this is, you know, printing on newsprint, you know, which, you know, soaks up the ink and just, you know, or this is on really, you know, so you can choose all those different things. So that's like a whole nother level that probably, you know, goes into this whole color management thing as well, right?
I mean, there is.
So it's like the master toaster having different kinds of toast.
Yes, or different kinds of bread.
Or bread. bread. Excuse me. Yeah. It's bread before the toaster.
Right. I mean, so, you know, Photoshop is a good example. Photoshop is a color manipulator. But to manipulate color, it needs to know what kind of color it has. Mm-hmm. So you tell it what kind of color it has by telling it your sRGB or Adobe RGB or Profoto RGB. And by the way, the main differences between those three are really the amount of color. So sRGB is a smaller color palette, meaning that if you think about it, you know, you're in high school or whatever, or grade school, and you go out and you buy the little 16 crayon box. Well, sRGB is like that 16 crayon box. There's only 16. It's a smaller number of possible colors. Okay. Adobe RGB is slightly bigger. It's like the 64 crayon box.
Gotcha.
And then Profoto RGB is like the really big, you know, you went all out and you got 128 crayon
box. So you might, the Profoto, why wouldn't you just always, I mean, doesn't that sounds like the best one to me.
Does sound like the best one. But then think about it this way. You know, you might have all these possible colors that are in that image, et cetera. But then when you go to print them, your printer is a limiting factor. Most printers can only also print a certain number of colors.
Right.
So it's possible for you to have more colors in your image than your printer can print.
So a lot of what you do is manage the color on this from the screen to the printer.
Exactly. What we do is we help people understand what's possible and basically temper your expectations. You can actually see something in nature that's really, really colorful. Take a picture with your digital camera, and the digital camera is a fairly good capture device. It'll capture, say, 90% of what you saw, what your human eye saw.
Mm-hmm.
And then your display is not so good. It might display about 80% of what's actually in the file. And then when you go to print, you might only get about 40% of it.
Boy, that's a great little bar chart there.
40%.
Or actually much less. You know, most commercial printing has probably between 4,000 to 6,000 discernible, distinct colors on the printing press.
So you're talking commercial printing versus your inkjet printer.
Your inkjet has a little bit more. It might have maybe something on the realm of like maybe 8,000 to 10,000 discernible colors, but the image itself could have up to several million colors.
Let me ask you a question. I mean, everybody knows that inkjets are, you know, the ink, they're the narcotics of the consumer color printing industry.
Gillette model,
I mean, you start using it, I need more of this. And I have a printer that's a Tektronix phaser, and it uses wax.
Thermal wax.
Yeah, and I love the thing. I mean, I have no print cartridges. I don't have this whole recycling issue to bring back giant things and all this kind of stuff. What's your opinion on the actual printers that, you know, that you run into? I mean, I really like my printer, and I've had inkjets, but, you know, I have them for a while, don't use them enough to get clogged. It's cheaper to buy a new one than to buy new ink.
Yes.
You know, what's your thought on this whole?
Well, you know, inkjet is really, really not a very green technology, but neither is your thermal phaser. You know, for your thermal phaser to actually work, it uses a lot of energy when it's running because it has to melt that crayon.
Right.
It has to keep it in a molten state. So, you know, there are pluses and cons with that. If you really want to be green, you know, email your stuff.
Don't print.
Like,
what kind of printer?
What kind of printer do you use? I mean, for the people out there, I mean,
What do you use?
What do you use?
Well, you know what? We're in an age where a $99 or actually a $49 little Epson or Canon inkjet produces such vivid color prints that you could not get earlier. So we're in a really good space right now, technology wise. The printers have a phenomenal color. They're getting much faster.
But that printer only lasts you three months until it dies.
That's right. Yeah,
and the ink costs more than the printer.
It's like, you know, the Gillette model. You got to buy those.
For a full set of ink, I could just buy a printer and that's total waste.
You know,
I mean, that's like massive amount of consumer plastic.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
The way springs
I do it,
and
the way I'm doing it, Al, is I'm not printing at my home.
Uh-huh.
I just always send my prints out to a print bureau because I know that they have a machine that's up and running. There, you're merging everybody's work into one place.
But people want instantaneous gratification.
I get that. And every time I go to a party and I don't have the photo for the gift, I feel like an idiot because I don't have a printer. But anyway, I hope that are helping people. If you have questions and comments about color management, what you should do, what the next step is, why it's not working for you, whatever your question is, or maybe you've got some comments on how you do things, what kind of printer you like, please give us a call and join the conversation. The phone numbers are 476-2800. Again, that's 476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. Again, that's 1-800-655-5877. You're listening to Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP. My name's Lyle Troxell. We have Miles Elam, Al Luckow, and Ben Jaffe. And our guest is Sun Doe from Rods and Cones, which is great that your name of your color management company is Rods and Cones. Chris, that's what's in the eye, and that's why we can see. So if you've got questions for us, give us a call. The phone number is, again, 831-476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. All right. So I want to try to isolate these different profile things because it always confuses me. So you've got a screen profile, and that is something you need a sensor on to put in front of your screen and get a good idea of how to produce correct color on your screen.
Color management falls to three profiles. You need a monitor profile, which is always active and working in the background to make sure you see something accurately.
And it's almost invisible to
everything
else.
It's almost invisible. Once you calibrate the monitor and you calibrate it regularly, you don't really have to worry about it. Okay. You have then a source profile. The source profile is, what's your image? Is your image one of the, is it an sRGB or WRGB or Profoto? And then you need an output profile. So that what you do is that when you go to file print in Photoshop, Photoshop has to convert the numbers from your source into the numbers for your destination so that it makes the best match. Remember that toast analogy?
Yeah.
If I want three, but I'm at your house, three is my source, and I'm at your house, and I did this little scaling with all the toast, then I need to convert my number three to, I think it was seven on yours.
All right.
And so that's what file print in Photoshop does with
profiles. And those printer profiles are also related to the type of material you have in the printer.
Type of material you have. So if you buy an Epson printer, you're going
to
get like a dozen Epson profiles because they're going to be
come
paper
with
specific.
Paper. And right, that's the other thing about them is you actually get those profiles for the printer from Epson. Yes. And that's when you're choosing what color type, you know, matte or this type of photo. That's part of the thing that it's doing is it's trying to calibrate it correctly for the color. It also has amount of ink and all that stuff as well. But for doing that calibration, if you want to do it yourself, if you don't trust that your printer is still doing the correct thing, you could build a profile with another sensor, right? One of those same sensors. You could print some red and sense it, and there's actually ways of doing that as well.
There are ways of doing that. You need what's known as a spectrophotometer. It actually measures reflective material, measures the light from the reflective material, and then it builds a color table. These things used to be around $10,000 10 years ago, but every year they get less and less expensive. And I think they're almost at the point right now where, you know, if you're fairly serious shutter bug and you really want your pictures to look good, I've talked about the sensor for the monitor. It's roughly about $100 to $250. A sensor for paper, for calibrating your printers, I think there are packages out there that include both monitor sensor plus a sensor for paper. I think it's about $500 or so.
And that would work if you're in a photo group, like a whole bunch of people get together. You kind of chip in, you buy one, and then everyone gets to use it. Because you only need to use it like once a month at most.
Well, the monitor you need to use about once a month to kind of, because the monitors will drift, but the printers have a much slower drift. So you can build a profile. It'll be good for years.
Oh, that's good to know. Yeah. And actually, a lot of these print bureaus actually will tell you the printer they're using so you can assign the profile to the image if you want.
That's correct.
Is that a good way to do it?
Well, Photoshop has a proofing function so that if you have a beautiful image and you're going to send it out to this particular bureau, you can actually engage what's known as the soft proof option and actually see on your monitor how it's going to print out at that particular bureau on that particular paper.
Oh, very cool. All right, we're taking calls now from Santa Cruz. Warren, welcome to Geek Speak.
Thank you.
What's your question today or comment?
Well, I was going to ask about advice on calibrating our screen depending on what the light is in the room. So, like during the daytime, the light is one way in my room. In the nighttime, it looks different. I assume that I would have to have two different color profiles depending on what time of day I'm working on. Is that true?
You know, that's an excellent question. And what we try to do is we try to get people to understand that light is a very, very subjective issue. In fact, our eyes are very sensitive to light. You walk outdoors and then you walk into a movie theater. It takes you about 10 seconds for your eyes to adjust. So our eyes are always scaling to the available light. The best thing to do...
And not just amplitude, they're also talking about color. So if you walk into a red room after about an hour and a half in there...
You're desensitized
to it. It won't look as red.
It won't look as red. So our eyes are very good at scaling. And what we really need to do is to basically understand that that's happening. And it's not really practical to always be calibrating to different lights because really what you're not calibrating the ambient room light. You're calibrating the monitor. So what you want to do is you want to make the monitor the brightest object in your field of view at all times. It doesn't matter if it's during the day. It doesn't matter if it's at night. The monitor should not be up against the window or anything else.
In fact, if you want to do good color management, you need to be in a dark room.
You need to be in a dark room, or you need to have a very effective monitor hood. It's probably the cheapest color management tool you can get. Build yourself a monitor hood.
What you're talking about is basically making
foam core and some duct tape.
Yeah, just making a shroud around your monitor that comes close to your face,
yes.
So that when you're looking forward, basically most of your vision is the monitor or darkness.
That's correct.
And that's the problem is that your white wall behind, which is maybe not exactly white, then as the sun hits it, depending on the time of day, it's going to override, and your eyes will adjust to that and make that the neutral look. And then the monitor itself gets overridden. Now, the other thing about that to note is, if you're dealing with a print, let's say you're making a print of a photo of something and you're working on it, in the morning it looks like one thing, in the afternoon it looks like something else because of the ambient light in the room and your eyes are adjusting. If you hung the print in the room like that, it would also do the same thing.
It would also do. And actually, inkjets are notorious for what we call metamerism, meaning that under one set of lights they'll look one way, under a different set of lights they'll actually change color. If you're doing a lot of things such as neutrals or black and whites, etc., if you have some natural daylight, it might look neutral. But if you have tungsten light, it's going to look very, very red. And if you have fluorescent light, it's going to look very, very green. So your viewing environment of prints, if you really, really are trying to match the monitor to the print, you really need to make sure that the light sources around you are what we call 5,000 daylight balance lights, so that they don't have a color cast and won't introduce a color cast into your artwork.
Did that answer your question, Warren?
Yeah, more or less.
It sounds like the shroud is the way to go. It sounds like making a shroud around your screen so that you're kind of blocking out ambient light.
You'd probably only need that during certain parts of the day.
That's true.
You know.
Well, but I would suggest get drapes.
Get drapes. Make the room dark.
High-tech solution.
Thanks, Warren, for the call.
Okay, thanks.
We have another call from Santa Cruz. If you'd like to call in, the phone numbers are 476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. Peter from Santa Cruz, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hey, thanks, guys. So I have an HP 91 monitor and an HP 932 printer, a couple of ancient things there. Mm-hmm. And I'm working out of Adobe 7. How do I calibrate the screen to the printer? So it seems to me that if I look at the screen and the printer prints out what I see on the screen, then I'm a happy chappy.
Right.
Yes.
So I guess you have to get something to actually calibrate your monitor, unless there's profiles available. But actually, monitors drift so much. This is a CRT, right? They drift so much.
But calibrate the monitor to the printer.
I think that's not the way you do it. Right.
What we do is we calibrate the monitor to a monitor standard, and then we measure the color of the available color output of the printer, and then we let Photoshop deal with transformation so that when you see something on your screen and that's the way you like it, when you go to file print, if Photoshop has a profile of the printer, it's going to go, this is the digital file, this is the digital information in the file, and I'm displaying it correctly on a calibrated monitor. So now when I go to print, if you tell me that this is the printer you're using and you have a profile that describes that printer's behavior, I will transform all the numerical numbers in that file to numbers that the printer will then output and match correctly what you saw on the monitor in the first place.
So the point is, you're not calibrating your monitor to your printer.
Yeah, they're two
different
pieces.
You're calibrating your monitor to some neutral concept, and you're calibrating your printer to some neutral concept.
That's important
so that when you get a new printer, you're not doing this again. Also, the way the software works, they isolate each other. And so you're really trying to calibrate the two of them independently. But the packages that you can buy to actually do the calibration, the little sensors, you can actually get a package that will do both.
Yes.
I hope that helps, Peter.
Yeah, you've completely confused me now, and now I'm going to go and cry somewhere. But thanks for the offer.
Bye, Peter. Sorry.
Bye-bye.
It's pretty complicated. I remember, Ben, when you set the show up, I said, yeah, we could. You said, can we do color on the radio?
It's a hard thing to do. It's a really hard thing to do.
Let's whip up some toast analogies.
Next week we'll have smell-o-vision.
This strawberry smells a little bit like this strawberry.
I really thought the Master Toaster comment sounded really ominous, considering the earlier news stories about, you know, robots
Cyberdyne
taking
systems
over the,
yeah. And stuff. We got one more call from Santa Cruz. Perry, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hi. Hey, I'm enjoying this show, and I had a question. I want to buy a bigger monitor that I can both use as a computer monitor and to watch movies on.
Oh, yeah.
And I was wondering if you guys or your guests could, you know, from the perspective of color, could tell me what to look for.
Wow, that's a really, really good question. You want something that would be really color accurate for the computer, but you also want to watch movies with it. Are you going to be using it, movies, digital projection from your computer, or are you hooking it up into your cable or HD?
Yeah, how are you going to watch the movies?
Probably just watch DVDs played on the computer.
Okay. In that case, then it's really easy. you know, there are lots of really good monitors out there. And what you want to do is, I would say that any modern monitor nowadays that has digital controls, first off, you have to get a monitor that has digital controls, because it'll give you the sharpest picture, and it also has the most color controls on it. And so, you know, make sure that you get something that with a nice digital interface. In terms of large monitors, there's a couple of really good 30-inch panels out there.
Can you give me a list and post on the website? Because
sure.
I think it's a good thing to reference and with links.
I mean,
and stuff.
Is there a difference between computer color and movie color?
Not through DVD projection, but there is a difference if you change the signal source.
Oh. Do-do-do, another topic. How do you get good color on TVs? Well,
yeah,
son,
this
is quite a complicated thing. Thank you for trying to do it with us on the radio. I really appreciate it.
And I'll forward you a link with a bunch of recommendations.
Great, and I'll post it on the site.
We have a good glossary and color FAQ on our website.
And we've actually linked over to your website. Your website, of course, is rodsandcones.com. And the rod shows black and white, right? And the cone shows color. Is that how it works?
Yeah, rods are really more sensitive to tonal values and not color. And the cones are what really kind of differentiate, you know, red, green, and blue.
And you can see movement with rods much better as well. In your periphery.
Geek Speak on KOSP is supported by Great Infusions Coffee Beanery and Espresso Machinery Showroom, offering artisans coffee, coffee makers, and specializing in home espresso machines, parts, and repairs. Located at 317
Petrera
Street.
We weren't ready for you.
On the corner of River Street in Santa Cruz, or online at www.greatinfusions.com. Geek Speak is a registered service mark of Online Tonight with David Lawrence and is used with permission. Today, on Geek Speak, we had Miles Elam, Ben Jaffe, and Al Luckout. Our guest is San Do. San Do is a co-founder of Rods and Cones. You can learn more about Rods and Cones at rodsandcones.com. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KOSP Santa Cruz, KBDH San Aldo, on the web at kosp.org. Geek Speak on KOSP is supported by Santa Cruz Electronics, offering an extensive selection of computer and electronic parts as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 Soquel Avenue and online at santacruzelectronics.com. I want to mention a book that I got in that's really awesome. It's called The Manga Guide to Electricity. If you or someone you know needs to learn about electricity, pick up this book. It's a cartoon type, you know, it's a manga thing, talking all about how electricity works. And reading through it, it feels like my associate's degree in electronics. So it's very cool. It's by three people. I won't even repeat the names, but I'll put the link up on the site. And it's from Umsha Publishing, The Manga Guide to Electricity, and I'll have it up on the website. Al, last week you told us a goofy tape dispenser, USB device, tape dispenser hub. What do you got this week for
this
a goofy
week,
USB?
The weekly goofy USB device is the USB aromatherapy oil burner.
What does it do?
Step one, add one drop of the included aromatherapy oil into the little X. Step two, insert into USB drive. Horizontal drives preferred to prevent drips.
Wait, so It doesn't actually do anything.
Heats up the
with
oil.
The computer just heats
and
things up.
Pretty soon, you're surrounded by beautiful lavender scents.
And if you have an electronic nose, then the cycle is completed.
Yes. Right.
For a lot of people, got some recursion going there.
For a lot of people, USB requires something high tech or some circuitry. Here, they just needed a resistor.
Right. They just need something hot.
Oh man.
Yep. Hey Perry, thanks for the call. I realize you're still with us. Thanks for calling in.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Ben, you got an issue?
Yeah. Really quickly, someone on the GeekSpeak Etherpad posted a story talking about how an electronic nose kind of thing, sensors, were integrated in, guess what? A cell phone. No. So this is ongoing.
We need to have a checklist of when it's actually a tricorder.
They're getting closer to tricorders. You were right indeed, Al, but I still think, I still maintain my original point, which is cell phones are not close.
This is Santa Cruz. This is Geek Speak on KOSP Santa Cruz, KBDH San Ardo, streaming live and podcasting at kosp.org. For KOSP and for Geek Speak, I'm Lyle Troxell. Stay tuned, coming up next with Car Talk. All the geeks today, thank you so much for being here. If you'd like to ask us questions during the week, don't forget forums.geekspeak.org.